Hey, Steve here again. Okay, I know I said that our shows would be published on Thursdays. Sorry, kind of got out of sync with that schedule just a little bit, but we'll be back to Thursday publications, should be with this podcast right now. You know, sometimes you just get going down the wrong path, and it's just so easy to keep on doing it. Well, today is episode 21, and I'm talking with Alan Fort, who's the superintendent of Quitman Schools in South Georgia. You'll hear us talk about ninth grade academies, his experiences as a school improvement specialist, and his focus on spreading the news of the needs of rural school systems. As a note, Mr. Fort is running for state school superintendent in Georgia. Teaching Learning Leading K-12 does not endorse candidates for political office. This is simply a conversation with a prominent educator in the state. Before I forget, I hope that you will stop by iTunes and give us a star rating and subscribe. Thanks for spending time with us. And if you get a chance, check out my contact info on the podcast page and send me a quick email. I'd love to connect with you. Best wishes and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 podcast, bringing you ideas and resources for K-12 classrooms, schools, and school districts. Hosted by Steve Mileto. And now, here's Steve with this week's show.
Hey, this is Steve. I'm back again with another episode of Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12. And today with me I have Alan Fort, who's the superintendent of schools in Quitman County in the state of Georgia. Say hi to everyone, Alan.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning to everyone out there in listening land.
Appreciate you joining me today, Alan. Let's start first by letting you talk about your background and who you are and what you're doing now.
Well, I've had 39 years of experience in education in Georgia. I've been a teacher, a coach, an assistant principal, a principal. I've worked for the State Department of Education for 5 years as a school improvement and redesign specialist. And now I'm a superintendent in Quitman County. And I've had the been very fortunate to travel around the state in the southeastern part, northeastern part, northwestern part, southwestern part. So I've been very fortunate in these roles to have seen the many different parts of Georgia. Georgia's a large state. It's very diverse. And although it's same in a lot of ways, it's very different in a lot of ways. And I think this has really helped me to form a vast educational background of exactly what we have to deal with in our state as far as educating the kids.
When we first met, I had actually asked if I could join a little get-together you were having of superintendents from rural counties. And what you were trying to do was connect the rural system so you could talk about some things that are common that impact all rural counties of Georgia. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
I did, Steve, because in part of my travels around the state, you realize that rural systems operate in a lot of isolation. Their little town or city that they operate in is 20, 30 miles from the next town, little town, but they're a little town too. And so that the resources are very limited. You can't just run out like a large city school and the resources are already there. Your educational resources are readily available. Money is readily available to fund these resources. And so a lot of times these rural schools operating in isolation suffer in isolation. But I thought from my travels that if we got together to kind of work together, it's almost like the barter system in the old days where they all would come to the town center and barter. And,
right.
And so that what I maybe have that I'm doing good in my little rural system, I can share with the other rural school systems and vice versa. I might have a great special ed program and what we're doing that I can share with three or four other systems that are really trying to form theirs to be a good one, or a good English department, or a little system that's developed these wonderful math lesson plans that I can share with my teachers that under ordinary situations mine can't because we are so small. And so we wanted to get together, and the other part was just to get together to kind of commiserate with one another. How are you doing? Man, budget woes are tough. Finding teachers are tough. You know, sometimes it's hard because we might even trade teachers. If a teacher wants to move or they might want to come to that area, because it's hard to find teachers. It's hard to find teachers because sometimes in little places, there's very limited places to live. And so it was nice to get together. We're going to continue this down the road to try to get ourselves together and meet and exchange ideas and exchange conversations.
Awesome. I appreciate you sharing that with us. Let's kind of shift gears to what you're doing right now. You're a superintendent of a school system in the state of Georgia, and what I'd like you to talk about is what's your greatest challenge?
I think the greatest challenge nowadays that I probably as a recent director meeting with your superintendents is to continually to get everybody motivated to teach and to learn. Teachers are under a lot of stress, a lot of demands to teach to this level of the test and teach to this standards and teach to these lesson plans and to teach all these kids. And kids come to school and there's a lot of demands placed on these children to really learn. And we should have rigor in our classrooms. We should teach hard because they need to be prepared for life. But we've taken a little fun out of school. We've taken a little play out of recess. We've taken a little chit-chat out of the halls and stuff. I mean, we should have a better environment sometimes for our kids and our teachers. And I think the hardest part is to make sure that as much as we can to make them happy at school and make them realize that it's not life or death every day that right. Little Johnny learns 2 and 2 is 4. If he just misses it, then we've got tomorrow. But if he doesn't learn it today, I have no choice because tomorrow we got to go to 2 plus 3.
Right.
And it's almost like there's a lot of pressure. And I think it's hard to make teachers and kids happy and to meet the financial demands that a lot of these little systems, you can't afford a whole lot. And there's a lot of demands to buy new stuff and get this stuff like technology and new books and new desks and new air conditioners and new this and replace this and replace that. While a lot of these go back to the rural systems and small systems, just can't raise that money like a large system can. And that's a part of the process and that we have to face and that we have to take care of.
Many of the systems those counties and districts have had industry shutter their doors over the last several years, haven't they?
That's right. You know, not only can you not raise money, what money you had might be less because those same industries that not only provided taxes and helped the millage rate, but those are also the people who maybe had to leave that left their houses that they're no longer paying property tax on, that they do not have kids in your school that count as an FTE. So while you still have to heat that building, gas up the same buses, pay for the same number of teachers because you didn't lose that many, what you did lose was significant enough to cause some financial hardship. And that's tough for these little local systems.
I can imagine. Let's kind of shift gears just a little bit because looking at your bio, you were a school improvement specialist for a while with the State Department of Ed. What were your experiences as you traveled across the state working with schools?
I think I'd been around the state. I've been to every school system at least 4 times in my life just because I started out in Georgia history and wanted to see all these places in Georgia. It's quite a fascinating state. From Dade County to Camden County, from Seminole to Rabun County, it's a wonderful place. And I would say that what I noticed was that a lot of these schools, rural schools, big schools, I would give everyone I saw, which was over 150 of them, middle and high schools, I would give so many of them an A+ just for effort, just for really trying. And some of these schools have to try to educate kids under really daunting circumstances. You have 100% of your students that are economically disadvantaged. 100% of them eat free. They come in every day. They're going to get their best 2 meals of the day at school. On the other hand, some of them come to school because that's just the place I kind of want to be and I'm not here to learn, but the teachers have to try to teach them, as we said earlier. The teachers have to try to teach them. The administrators have to try to keep them in line, and we have to try to figure out a way how can we make this student a viable citizen in our state. But I've seen great schools in our state. The teachers, administrators, parents, support staff are just working really hard to try to provide these kids with a great education in our state. And I think it's from small rural schools to large inner city schools. They all I hate to say the term fight the battle, but they fight the battle to educate these kids every day, and I give them an A for their effort. They do. And it's wonderful to see these schools take them in, get them in class, start class, and work hard to try to educate these kids so that they can be, wage-earning citizens later in their lives.
That's awesome. I can imagine it's quite an interesting experience going from corner to corner.
It is. You see these just different. You can drive 50, 60 miles and see two or three or four different types of little societies in our state.
Awesome. Let's talk a little bit about something else that I found in your bio. I know that as a principal, you initiated one of Georgia's first ninth grade academies.
Yeah.
And tell me why and what lessons you learned.
I did it because we kept getting in like 400 ninth graders, and coming up from the eighth grade, and we kept having 600 ninth graders. These figures don't quite.
What's going on with these numbers, right?
Yeah, and when we got into, No Child Left Behind and figuring out graduation rates, and we really had to get a separation. And we were just mulling. What you looked at back in, like, class rosters is that, Steve Mileto is in his third year as a ninth grade English, is sitting here with little Alan Fort, who just little old snotty-nosed kid coming up from eighth grade, and I'm wondering what kind of influence Steve might have on little Alan here.
Probably not good influence, that's for sure.
And so what we wanted to do was to actually create pure ninth grade classes. And this allowed us to keep a monitoring on the pure first-year ninth graders. And then what was kind of funny, I guess it was to most of us, is that the second year ninth graders, we moved in them into a class called Purgatory. They had their own homerooms. They were in their own little wing of the school. And we set up ninth grade repeater classes in the regular school. So we could keep hands on our true ninth grade students and find out who they were, where they were, what their progress was. So it was not as much to separate them from the rest of the school, and some schools like to do that, but ours was so we can have a clear vision of who our ninth graders were. Their teachers knew who they were. We could keep tracking data on them. We could use, support some of those who were having a hard time, and really focus on this class so that if we took in 400 ninth graders, we knew exactly what all 400 of those were doing. And then the other 150 or so repeater 10th graders, we could also create in the purgatory, just find out where they were. And we actually had a little thing where if they made their classes because usually if you stick them back in ninth grade, they're stuck in ninth grade.
Yes.
But we
had
the arrangement where that were to motivate them, where if you got your credits up, we would make you a sophomore and put you in a sophomore home room.
That's awesome.
In January when we came back from their first year. So they had that motivation to them. So we actually did it as a motivator for our students who were having to repeat some classes, but used it to really closely monitor our ninth graders so we could keep a knowledge of where they were and what they were doing.
That's awesome. I know that being able to create opportunities to extend the learning, which is what you're doing,
right,
for those ninth graders, and then the opportunity to earn that way into, instead of saying that you got to just do the whole thing all over again.
It was good because we had it where we could work it out. Some of our ninth grade classes might be big. They might have had 25, 27, 28 kids, but we knew how to stack them in there, and especially your upper class kids were going to be no discipline problems. On the other hand, for our repeaters, they might have a ninth grade English class that only had 12 to 15 kids, so we could pay special attention to them and help them to move up to the 10th grade instead of just clunking them back in a ninth grade class where you had first-time ninth graders and repeater ninth graders and who wanted to be in the 10th grade, who might be 16 years old, so that we could really use this opportunity to clearly focus on the kids who needed help.
That's great. That's what's needed. You have to find those kids who need that mm-hmm. help and target them and work with them. Let's talk about, in shifting gears, let's think about today. In today's schools, what do you think are some of the greatest challenges that a classroom teacher faces today?
I think my wife teaches, and we talk every night. She teaches fifth grade, and she works hard, tries hard, and I sense a lot of motivating the students. And you know, when I went to school, I'm pretty old now, and we had chalk and chalkboard and books. And so that was your world, you know, whatever knowledge was in that book and in that teacher that you had and in your parents. School kids come to school nowadays, this teacher is third or fourth or fifth on the list of where I can access knowledge, you know, behind internet, when we went to school, our knowledge was limited as to the book we were reading and the person we were talking to.
Hey, right.
These kids go home and they have unlimited knowledge. They can access anything that's ever been done on this internet, trade ideas on Facebook, texting, emailing, all this stuff. So we've gone in almost a decade from limited knowledge to unlimited knowledge. And our teachers are now, remember, these teachers, any of them that have probably 10 or more years experience, came from the limited knowledge college.
That's good. I like that.
And they're teaching kids, especially from 5th to 12th grade, who really get into that, that have unlimited access to knowledge. And teachers are kind of coping with this. When I start talking about Shakespeare, then this teacher's talking in the context of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. These kids might have actually gone and researched Shakespeare, and they're familiar with every work he's ever done. And I think sometimes it's hard for our teachers to figure out how to really motivate or keep up with the kids who have this unlimited knowledge, because you remember, and this is where we got to realize, is that when you and I were coming through school, we were all equal, because like I said, your parents, your teacher, and your book were your knowledge, where you got knowledge.
Yes.
Okay, that's it. It's very limited, and we were basically all equal in that. We had the parents, we had the teacher, we had the book. So we're all equal in that. Now, we have kids who go home to the most brand new computer, high-speed internet, and they're, you know, nerdy, geeky, or just a techno whiz, whatever you want to call them.
Yes.
They sit in the same class with the kid who goes home to no books, doesn't have a computer. So the diversity between kids in class today are tenfold, from 0 to 100, where we might have this little 5 to 10 disparity here. These kids, their worlds of knowledge. So a teacher has to teach a kid that's already investigated Shakespeare and all of his works to a kid who doesn't even have a book at home to read and barely takes the book home now to read. And so we have such diversity. Teachers have this problem to really find where the learning middle is, or the learning curve is, for these kids, because she's got this kid sitting here that already knows everything, this kid who doesn't have anything and might not care. And it's hard for teachers to find that middle ground to make sure that they teach what needs to be taught. It's above this kid's head, and this kid already knows about it.
That is a picture that it just totally exists. Some of them just right there in their phones. They may not know how to use the phone the right way, but it's got you know, access to so much more information than we ever had. And it's cool.
I mean, I was talking to someone earlier at the conference, and it's like you and I had to use pencils to do math problems so we could erase.
That's true.
I'm not going to age you too much. Well, they got in their pocket right here, they've got a calculator that can answer any mathematical problem or formula right there. You can go to Wolfram Alpha application, and it will tell you any formula that ever exists. Planck's theory, Schrodinger's theory, anything that exists, it will tell you what it is right then and there.
It's amazing. It's just amazing the information they can have access to now.
That's right.
You know, we're just talking about some of the challenges. What I'd like you to do is talk for a minute about, because it's incredible teaching and working with kids. And so what I'd like you to talk about for a minute is, do you have a favorite memory of either, whether it's a principal or teacher working with kids?
I think I've been, like I said, this is my 39th year, and I think if I was about 20 years ago, one or two might stick out. But I think that I will say this, because I have so many of them, but I'm going to pick these two young men, Dallas and Dennis Smith, who lived in the housing projects in Albany, South Albany, Georgia. They came to Westover. They were two very talented. They were good kids, and they were very talented football athletes, football players, basketball players. And I coached them in defensive backs, and I would take them, my day to take them back, we had to bus them back to South Albany. It was at Westover, which is north part. They were busing students, and we would take them back home after football practice in the evenings. And they'd sit up there next to me. They were juniors and seniors when I was there, and we would talk about life and, hey, coach, what you do, how you do this, how you do that. And I would drop them off at their place, and they lived with their mom, single mom, their grandmother, their aunt and her child. And Steve, they could have quit right there, but they had this little inner determination, and we, the coaches, helped them to go to college, and they got two football scholarships to Valdosta State, played at Valdosta State. The greatest thing is they graduated from Valdosta State.
Awesome.
Dallas is in the Valdosta State Hall of Fame.
Oh, my.
And both of them are in education.
Awesome.
Dennis is in education in Cincinnati, Ohio. He married a lady that worked for Procter & Gamble. They make diapers anyway.
Okay.
And Dallas is actually the basketball coach at Westover High School, where he went to high school and is very
Excellent.
Successful there. And I think when you see, and there's thousands of those kids, I say Dallas and Dennis because I just saw Dallas the other day when I went through Albany. But to see these kids, and that's what you get upset sometimes, is that they had every reason in the world to not do anything.
Right.
To quit, walk the streets. But they had opportunity, and they took advantage of that opportunity. And, you know, today's kid with Hope Scholarship, scholarships that are out there, colleges that will take these kids in, every kid, if they make it through high school, can just about go to college, technical college, two-year college, and can become a success, just like Dallas and Dennis did. They were two twin brothers. I was the only person who could tell them apart almost. And so, they took advantage of that. And the great thing is that they have kids. And you know what? Their kids are going to be college educated. And we went from where you had a family of high school dropouts in a way to, in one generation, we've created a family of college graduates. When I just talking about college, going to college.
Corrected it.
It's in one fell swoop because you had, I'd say myself, the coaches, the teachers, but basically you had two kids that just says, I'm getting myself out of this. And our society offers this to everybody nowadays, Steve. We don't leave anybody out. We've got all these technical colleges and the military and colleges that all any of these kids, if they just get the muster about them, the motivation to be somebody, they can do that. And we should have educators, all educators around the state should have thousands and thousands of these success stories, because we should be doing this for these kids, like what happened to Dallas and Dennis. There should be hundreds, thousands of these kids that can do that.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing. We're getting close to the end, and before we close, one of the things that I wanted to get you to, I know that you're running for state superintendent,
right.
And what I'd like you to be able to do is just share a place where people who are listening could find out more about your position and your background.
My website is at www.allenfortga.com, and that has most everything that we address in, like, that I feel needs to be out there addressed. Certainly, if you have any questions, there's an email link on there. I have a Facebook, Allen Ford SUPT. I have a Twitter account, Allen Ford SUPT.
Right. We're into the social media.
I have a phone, which is on the website. It's amazing, like I said, when you get all these, I'm either texting, emailing, tweeting, or phoning all the time. You're always in contact with somebody. And so I want to run for state school superintendent because I am an educator, and I believe that an educator And an educator with leadership experience such as you and I have needs to be the state leader of education. We need somebody who's had experience being an educator, who's had experience with kids, who's had experience around the state, dealing with teachers, parents, community, businesses, and that has an education background needs to be the chief educational leader of our state. It is that important to me, just as we talked about the kids and the teachers. We've got to finish this process. I mean, we this is my little line. I use it. People kind of rear back and say, well, I didn't realize that. You know why 2014-15 is important? Is because in 2050, the kids who are in kindergarten right now will be 41 years old. They will be in the prime of their earning life. Are we planning for them? And if not, then we should be ashamed, because that's who we need to plan for, are these kindergartners. And because they've got 13 more years of school left. And by the time they graduate in 13 years, which will be about 2027, somewhere around in there, have we prepared these kids to enter the world? Because what we do now is preparing those kids for that. We don't need to wait till they're juniors and seniors, but we need to prepare them right now for what, because they're going to look back, and when they're 41 or 42 and 43, and says, thank God those people in 2014, 15, and 16 prepared me for where I am now.
Thank you very much for sharing that. As we're closing here, and we're going to bring it to a close, is there anything else that you'd like to share before I get to my last question?
I think that education in Georgia, for those who listen to this, the educators, I want to commend you for doing the wonderful job you do. And I'm not just talking about teachers. I'm talking about the bus drivers who get these kids to school safe and sound and then take them home safe and sound. I'm talking about the school food service workers who prepare these meals for these kids. They get up early so they can have breakfast ready, and they stay late to clean the kitchen up so it'll be ready the next day when they get there. I'm talking about the janitors, custodians who keep the schools clean and livable for these people to go to school and attend schools in a nice place. Some of these places are very, very nice. They keep nice. Some of these places are 30, 40, 50 years old. They don't look a day over 20, because these people have take pride in that school building to keep it nice and clean and good looking. You know, the secretaries that keep the school running, they're the, while the administrators certainly are the run the school, these secretaries and administrative assistants are certainly the backbone of the school to keep it going. They're the people in the community that they know. You know, the parapros who help the teachers, who help these kids. And so I think we need to recognize the whole, you know, educational community who help kids learn, the businesses and communities, the parents who support the teachers and their kids in the schools. That we need that in our state of Georgia, from my travels that we've talked about, I see millions of people who actually take pride in our schools and school system, because they realize how fortunate we are in this country. Now, when these schools take a beating and this, that, and the other, that what other country spends the money we do to educate a child from 3 years old to almost 22 years old in the state of Georgia? Because remember the Hope Scholarship and the Hope Grant. That how many places in the world pay for a child's education for what amounts to 16, 17, 18 years if you count Head Start.
Right.
You're talking about we and the what we have, that we take every kid every day, regardless of knowledge, regardless of sex, color, economic income, where they live, who they are, where they came from, if they've been here since 1734, as my family has, or they got here 17 hours ago. That we take care of these kids, try our best to educate them as best we can to give them a decent life. And then what other country does that as far as our country? And then as for my state of Georgia, what other state just does it as good as we do with what we the hand we're dealt with and the variety and of kids that we have. And I don't think there's any better state that does out there that tries to really work with our students and our teachers to provide a great world-class education for our students.
Thank you very much. Well, in closing, what I'd like to do is I would like you to think back to when you were in school, K-12, and was there a teacher or educator who you would thank today if you could, and what would you say to them?
Well, I'm going to take two.
All right.
The first one is hits home because my mother was a teacher, and my aunt was actually a teacher, so I saw a teacher every day, and my mother, and I saw the work that she did. She just didn't leave school at 3 o'clock and come home and do nothing. You know, they come home just like my wife is a teacher now, and she comes home and works almost as hard at home as she does at school, preparing and getting ready, just like my mother did. And she was dedicated. She loved those kids. She loved her kids. Sometimes I thought she loved those kids more than she liked me. You know, it seemed like she was always nice to her kids and always mean to me. Make up your bed, clean up your room, you know, and I said, yeah. But I understand that she had tremendous value to not only me, but all the children that she had. And I'll say Coach Jack Hamill was my sixth grade teacher. And he was the first man teacher I ever had, which almost let me, you know, because in that when I went to school, most of your teachers were female. But he actually, where he was a coach and he was just a good guy, and he kind of opened up the world that this is an option for me if I wanted to go into education, because I see a man can go into education and he can make a difference. You just don't have to be a man job. You can be a teacher. And that actually helped to influence me at a point that I, between my mother and Coach Jack Hamill, that I could go into education and make a difference in my life and the lives of other people that I teach and work with.
Awesome. Thank you very much for sharing that. Thank you to Alan for spending so much time with me today. I appreciate it.
Steve, I appreciate it very much myself, man.
And enjoy. It's good connecting with you again. Enjoy the weekend coming up, and good luck in all the activities coming
up.
It's a
state school superintendent campaign. It takes a lot out of it. It's relentless. But I care about my state. I care about the people I work with. I care about these kids that we have, and I care about the future of my state, that I want it to be as successful, and it's only as successful as many of the educated kids we can produce. So thank you for having me, Steve. I appreciate this opportunity.
That's great. Thank you very much, Alan. Have a great one.
Hello, listeners. We want to remind everyone to check out all of our digital content at teachinglearningleadingk12.com. That's teachinglearningleadingk12.com. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Just search Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 in the iTunes Store. Check back often for updates and new material.
You have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, recorded in Eastman, Georgia, at the Heart of Georgia Precinct.